Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York City. With you Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays normally to bring you things about psychology, things about the human mind, what it is, how it works, why people do what they do, how you can learn about people and learn about yourself. Kind of lead us to a more peaceful world. Today we want to talk about a difficult subject because we have been talking, as you've been hearing, today is a day that's been dedicated to the disease of AIDS. And it has a lot to do with, a lot of it is spread around different countries where women have no choice but to have sex with men who are just raping and pillaging and spreading disease. Well, I want to talk about this idea of choice and what happens, and I want to take it back all the way to the beginning, to where choice is not affected, and I want to talk about childhood sexual abuse today. The effects of childhood sexual abuse, I want to talk about incest. My guest today by telephone from Washington is counseling psychologist Dr. Christine Courtois, C-O-U-T-O-I-S, C-O-U-R-T-O-I-S. Who's written a book on the subject. Christine, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, let's start. I mean, it's been a long time since people have paid attention to it, and I think we have to go back and find out what we've learned. And what about childhood sexual abuse? Let's talk about incest specifically. How would you define incest?
Incest is any type of sexual contact or experience between related or quasi-related individuals where there is a lack of consent.
A lack of consent, but, you know, a child consents to things that are, that, you know, they may not even know is a sexual thing.
Right, then we wouldn't consider that to be really consent because a child, and that's part of the definition, by his or her very nature, a child is immature and unable to give informed consent.
So it's kind of, if with the exception of informed consent, so it's adult consent, it's somebody knowing everything and giving consent, and of course children don't do that. So incest is any kind of sexual contact. Incest doesn't just mean penetration and...
No, it doesn't. And in fact, it can be considered incestuous to even do sexual things in a child's company, so not doing them directly to a child or showing a child pornography, for example, with the intention of stimulating the adult or the child or both. Anything that would be considered out of bounds of a relationship that is supposed to be protective.
Yeah, incest is such a big word. You know, you and I both know in our work with multiple personality disorder that when you get isolated and you get a child isolated somewhere out in the boondocks where they don't have anybody watching closely, where the schools may not be seeing the effect, a lot of things take place in isolated places that, you know, the parents figure, well, what the hell? There's nobody who I'm going to be accountable to, you know? And,
yeah.
And what they may do is talk to or show or demonstrate or stimulate a child just by just because they feel like doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it usually meets some kind of need on their part, and what you're describing about the isolation is usually what one of the things that happens in an incestuous family, and often these families have other problems as well, such as alcoholism. You often hear that the family is kept isolated from the community, that children are discouraged from bringing anyone home and from having friends, and that makes for a very vulnerable and a very accessible child both, and a child who may become more dependent on a perpetrator than would otherwise happen by virtue of the fact that there's nobody else there.
So if a woman were to say, I've been incested by my father, when she walks into a therapist's office, or if she walks into a courtroom, or she walks into a prison, not a prison, a police station, they'd take immediate action against the father. And if she, what she meant was that when I was 10 years old, my father showed me Playboy, You're saying that that falls in the category of incest?
Well, you have to make a distinction between what is legally incest in a particular state. I would consider it incestuous behavior, and that's a clinical definition rather than a legal definition. So you need to make those kinds of, discriminations, if you will.
But from what I'm hearing from you, Christine, you don't like it. You just don't like anybody doing anything sexual with a non-consenting adult who's not fully informed.
A non-consenting child.
A non-consenting child.
Yes. Yes, because it is what we call potentially traumagenic, potentially very, very destructive. It's not always, depending on how it happens. But the probability, especially if you're talking about adult child, and especially if you're talking about parent child, the probability of damage is very, very high.
Well, I understand, except that, and of course I agree with you completely, but just to take the other side for just a moment, people who are beating their children, right, can be getting some kind of a charge out of it that is almost sexual in nature. I've seen that with people who are sadistically beating their children. We don't call that rape. We don't call that incest.
But we might call it incestuous. Again, that's where the qualifier goes on to it, because if the person is, in fact, becoming sexually aroused in the course of beating, and the beating, is just seen as, is understood as physical, but the perpetrator or the offender is getting aroused, then it has a sexual component, and then I would call it incestuous.
Okay, a woman comes to see me, and she said to me the other day, this is recently, she said she likes to take her son, her son is a baby, like 1 year old or less, and she likes to take his penis in her mouth, and she likes to jiggle it around because it makes him laugh so much.
Mm-hmm.
She said she doesn't get it. Yeah, she only does it because he finds it so much fun and he giggles.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking incest?
I would say we are, and we're talking very inappropriate behavior.
Certainly inappropriate behavior,
uh-huh.
But
and,
she's not getting stimulated.
She says she's not. She might be.
Yeah. The courts would consider that one.
Yeah, I think she then needs to be, help with her parenting, that this is an inappropriate way to parent a child.
Well, now you bring up something really important. We have people who are incested, and we have people who incest. Now, when we usually think of incest, we think of a parent with a child or a parent surrogate with a child.
Mm-hmm.
What about brother and sister?
Well, it's turned out that that is more common. Sibling incest seems to be more common than has been known previously, and there's been, in the past 30 years, a significant amount of research that's been done on the topic of incest per se. And we also know that especially if there's an age difference and a size difference between siblings, and often in terms of older brother, younger sister, that type of incest can be extremely damaging in and of itself. And when we look at, you mentioned parental incest and father-daughter incest, any incest that occurs in the nuclear family, by that we mean parents, step-parents, or siblings, seems to have a higher potential for damage because the child is more accessible to the person who's perpetrating, and therefore there's more opportunity for repeat contact. And when there's repeat contact, if this is not enough to add insult to injury, over time, if the abuse hasn't started with some kind of penetration, over time it's likely that that will happen. So it becomes ever more serious and has the potential for ever more serious repercussions.
Young boy is 12 years old. He has an 11-year-old sister. He, she's always kind of get his favor. He has sex with her. How do we punish him?
I think he needs to be held accountable for what he's done, and he definitely needs treatment, because that kind of scenario may repeat itself over and over again, and there are different treatment methods, and again, depending on a state and what the state law is, it may involve more punishment via the criminal justice system.
So we're saying that a boy of 12 years old, if he's so screwed up as to want to have sex with his 11-year-old sister if his, you know, hormones are running wild, somehow he should have been told this is not what you're supposed to do.
Right, and this should be parental supervision.
So
what happens,
aren't we punishing the parents?
Well, I was just going to get to that. What happens very often and what's been found in sibling incest is that the parents themselves may be unavailable or negligent. And in some cases, siblings turn to one another for solace that may become sexual. So, you know, there are many variations on sibling incest. And before we automatically talk about punishment, we do have to talk about an understanding of the dynamics of that particular circumstance.
Let's go there. Would you spell that out for us?
Well, I mean, if the particular circumstance is that the parents are very, very negligent and the children were left to their own devices, that might be very different than a 12-year-old boy who's out of control and predatory of all kinds of children, not just his younger sister. So he may be much more in need of incarceration and intensive treatment than a child who, by virtue of neglect, acts out.
And when we incarcerate a 12-year-old boy, he's going to have more sexual experiences wherever he's incarcerated than he would ever have at home.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that.
Incarceration doesn't seem to ever cure anybody, especially.
Yeah, I think you're bringing up another issue, you know, which is that juvenile sex offenders have been identified as a special population. And the viewpoint seems to be if they're treated sooner rather than later, there's a better chance, certainly, of redirecting their behavior. But as in all treatment, whether for victims or offenders, there has to be safety involved. And they have to be safe from any kind of predation.
Right. Don't you feel like your hands are tied at times where you would love them to be safe, but yet incarceration seems to be the only option?
Oh, absolutely.
No, they're not going to be? I mean, how?
Absolutely.
How does a psychologist, you know, justify? But we're speaking with Christine Courtois, Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy. How did you get onto this work, Christine?
Well, in 1971 at the University of Maryland, I was involved when we had a series of gang rapes from the dormitory that I was director of, and we started a rape crisis center, and we had young girls start calling in saying, oh, I'm not being raped by a stranger, I'm being raped by someone in my family. And when I looked at the literature, there was very limited literature on incest and what to do to help, and it was about time for me to do my dissertation. So I was encouraged to start studying this topic. And I initially believed that incest was like rape, coming from a rape trauma background, and I found out that it's much, much more complicated by virtue of the family dynamics and the kinship and the blood ties that make it very complicated.
So there's no simplification of it by in its complication. We're not talking about rape. When we talk about incest, we're not just talking about rape. We're talking about something else as well.
Right. We're talking about a specialized form of rape with just enormous complexities because there are ongoing relations. This is not involving strangers, and it's not a one-time occurrence typically, but it is involving individuals who have ties and ongoing relationships to the victim. That he or she needs to navigate very, very carefully, and that creates an enormous strain on an individual, on a developing child.
My assistant producer here, Stephanie Dombra, who you've spoken to earlier, had a couple of questions for you.
Okay. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
Yes, I was wondering about the difference, then, if there is an incident that is just one or two times within a family. What have you seen about the long-term effects of a single incident or, you know, one or two versus the multiple kind of repeated incidents within the family as well?
Well, what I've learned is never to equate one time means that it's less severe. One time can be extraordinarily severe depending on how it happened and how the victim experienced it. And in some cases, long-term incest, surprisingly, may not be as severe in repercussion as other types of abuse within the family. So we can never predict one-to-one, but on average, the longer the duration, the more progression and the more severity can be expected.
What are some of the classic symptoms that would appear in somebody who's been incested?
Well, are you talking about short-term or longer-term?
I'm talking about manifestations in the adult life.
Okay. It's been found in recent years that a high proportion of individuals who've had a history of child sexual abuse and incest within the context of a family that doesn't work very well go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, which may or may not show when they're children, but may emerge in their adolescence or adulthood. And very often that's accompanied by a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety reactions. And then along with that, individuals who have been repeatedly coerced and transgressed against often develop very, very negative sense of self and have a lot of shame and humiliation about themselves and what's happened to them. They may also have quite a number of physical effects, some of which might come directly from the abuse. But what's been learned in recent years is that the body under stress carries a very, very heavy physiological load, and that for some adult survivors, they may actually end up with medical conditions that are the long-term play out of acute stress responses.
Are there any classic symptoms?
Yes.
Medical conditions?
Irritable bowel syndrome, things like fibromyalgia, chronic pain, also a full range of gynecological problems.
How do you make the connection between something like fibromyalgia and this, if you were just speculating the connection?
Well, the connection that's being made is the body under chronic stress has an overabundance of stress hormones that are always on, and the theory is that the body starts to work against itself. The immune system starts to fail, and fibromyalgia or chronic pain or MS is another type of thing that we see, maybe that the body is actually working against itself because of the degree of stress. Some other long-term issues that might emerge are oftentimes there are major relationship difficulties because individuals who have been hurt by those who are supposed to protect them often are very mistrustful of other people, especially authority figures. And they may also have great difficulty being in intimate relationships, and especially getting married, because once I have seen what I call the incest survivor U-turn, for some survivors, once they're married, then they're again expected to be sexual with someone who's related to them. And although that might sound a little bit weird, it sort of often catches up with people in an unconscious kind of way.
Well, let's go over that just a little more. In other words, a person who is sexually incested, who's incested, they grow up and they could go along fine, they could have relationships, they could have sex, and then when they get married,
yeah,
because of the expectation of marriage, because they're expected to have sex, it flips them back into the childhood kind of ideation, the kind of environment where they now feel like once again they are obligated to have this sex, and it kind of brings them back to some kind of regression? Or
yes, that doesn't happen to everyone, but I've seen it enough to know that that is one of the effects that happens, and it might be much easier to be intimate with someone when they're not related. So that some individuals at the point of getting married, which obviously is supposed to be a happy occasion, they may find out that things don't function so well and they have this boomerang reaction, which can be shocking.
High incidence of codependency as well?
Yes, because many of these families where incest is ongoing have a history of substance abuse, and so there may be learned patterns of caretaking, and in fact the family role may be passed down to children about taking care of the parents. There's a role reversal, and that may be a way that they learn to interact with other people, is that it's learned caretaking or enabling, whatever, or codependence, whatever you want to call it. But many survivors are very self-sacrificing in that way. And when you put that with their low self-esteem, they don't expect anybody to do for them, but they're doing for everyone else. They can be extremely self-sufficient. That's one of the things that I see in therapy a lot is, you know, they're taking care of everyone else and don't expect anything for themselves.
And Christine, what are the differences between the men and versus women with the symptoms?
I think a lot of the symptoms are the same, but of course it's been much more difficult for males to discuss incest and sexual abuse because, of course, it's not supposed to happen to boys. And what I've seen in my own practice in recent years, I have about a 50-50 male-female practice now, is that many men are coming forward, especially as a result of the priest abuse scandal,
right,
which has made it much more a public issue and much more acceptable for men to talk about their abuse.
Yeah,
so that one of the primary things I've seen is difficulty disclosing and difficulty acknowledging, and then there is this whole gender issue that comes up because to be a victim is to be unmale in, you know, the masculine, our connotation of what it is to be masculine. So it may be very difficult for a male victim to have to deal with that.
Well, but, you know, I remember hearing of a young boy, a 14-year-old boy, whose babysitter, who happened to be 17 years old, was a girl, and she had sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
And now, in a way, and he talks about this as one of the greatest moments of his life.
Uh-huh.
Now, where's the damage?
Well, often there's hidden damage in circumstances like that, especially...
Do you think it's possible that there's no damage?
I do. At times I do. It again depends on the circumstance, but unfortunately our society has done a very good job of saying when it's a female perpetrator of a male that it's a seduction and not an abuse. And very often males will minimize and make sense of it by saying, wasn't this wonderful, when in fact it wasn't so wonderful. So, you know, that has to be assessed very, very carefully. And our society has a double standard about that, as we've seen from the recent Lefauver case and the Mary Kay Letourneau case, you know, that it's misinterpreted as a love relationship.
No, bring us up with the two cases you're talking about.
Well, the Mary Kay Letourneau case is the case out on the West Coast where she actually spent 7 years in jail for having had sex with her, I think at the time he was a 12-year-old student.
Right.
And she had targeted him from a very early age. And she recently was released from jail and ended up marrying this young man, and they have posited it as the great love affair of the century. And the state certainly didn't buy that in terms of putting her in prison. But she's born two children by this young man and recently married him, and, you know, it was, in a way, I mean, it's now consensual, but in a way it looked much more legitimized.
Hmm. Yeah, and the other case?
The other case is a female teacher also who has been found guilty, and she recently got, I think it's a suspended sentence, that she's not going to do any jail time, and there's a lot of controversy about that right now.
And what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see very intensive treatment, regardless of gender. I think incarceration is also very appropriate,
depending on
how the circumstance happened.
It just sounds like the incestor is invariably a victim as well, and that, you know, of course you can't compare the victimization of a child. But when we talk about treatment, we always talk about treatment for the abused, and we rarely address treatment for the abuser.
Which is very unfortunate, because it should be at least equal in order to stop some of the abuse from occurring. And what has been found, which is interesting, is that not every abuser, him or herself, has been sexually abused. So that's a myth. But that each abuser has significant needs or problems that they are projecting onto other people. And that needs treatment.
There are many groups now held where, you know, groups and areas where they could find treatment, where
yes.
they could get hold of themselves. Because,
yes.
you know, being a pedophile is murderous, you know,
yes.
on the inside. It feels terrible. You know you're doing wrong.
Right. But also one of the things that the majority of perpetrators do is rationalize their behavior, which allows them to continue it. And most of them, if you were to ask them what they did and how they did it, would, you know, unless they've been really heavily confronted, they will deny what they've done and the extent of it, only to go on and repeat it again.
I wanted to go back to that point, Christine, about the long-term damage that you
mm-hmm.
were talking about.
Uh-huh.
I recently read an article in a psychological publication that said it is not really the sexual abuse that does the long-term damage, but all the other neglect and the physical abuse, the violence, and the other things that children endure. And I wondered what your experience has been, because if you just take the sexual abuse, is that really the issue? Because all the families that are in those kind of settings, the isolated settings, as you described, there's all these other things going on that
right.
that are contributing. So what has been your understanding of that latest research?
Well, I would say yes and no. I think we have to be very, very even-handed about this and to appreciate that, you know, the entire family setting is an important influence, and there's a lot of new research coming out of the developmental psychology these days about what's called attachment trauma, where children are not securely attached or related to in a way that's healthy for them, and that often is a precursor to further abuse in the family. But on the other hand, we shouldn't look too only at those dimensions of family life and minimize or deny the impact of the sexual contact per se. I think we have to be even-handed and look at both. It's too easy to go one way or the other. I think it's not one or the other. I think it's both.
My guest has been Christina Courtois, Courtois. The name of the book, Healing the Incest Wound, Adult Survivors in Therapy. It's in paperback. It's a valuable work. I think the detail that you go into, Christina, and is tremendous. I think that for people who have suffered incest, if you want to learn more about it and treatment options, do pick up the book. We'll be back with you in a little bit. Christina, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Okay.
So this is Michael Franti from Spearhead saying, whoop, whoop, we come and never pre-recorded, live and direct, it's just listener supported on WBAI. Peace.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Eternal Egypt. Phil Thornton, Thornton, for those of you who always want to know what's the music we play. Eternal Egypt. Very serious subject, all of the things that create this kind of pain. Our telephone number here today is 212-209-2900. Once a week, if possible, I try to leave room for your telephone calls, because this is the Public Affairs Department of WBAI. I want to leave room for your phone calls. We presented two programs this week that were pretty dynamic. And then Tuesday, we will not be with you. There'll be a special broadcast. So I want to hear from you people as well. What's going on for you? What are your reactions to some of what you're hearing? What are your feelings about it? 212-209-2900 is our number here. Our guest was Christine Courtois, who is speaking about the effects of incest and about the abuse of women primarily as we know it. And men who describe it. Now, many men describe the sexual abuse by other men as being more coercive. But society does a very funny thing about men who are seduced. They call it seduction. And they make that not as criminal. And maybe it's not. 212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. I'm here. I know you're there. Well, maybe we should take another call, Michael. Hello. 212-209-2900. When this always gets started, we have just a moment or two to catch up. I know somebody's actually there right now, but I can't hear you speaking. Hello? Let's move on to the next caller. That's it. Well, maybe we were just hearing from somebody who was just emotionally overwrought. Hi there.
Hi, Armand.
Hi.
Great show. I think this should be covered a lot more. In my own recovery, I found that I think the world could be a better place if people handled their own unresolved issues, and that's from, like, all parts of society. But in your opinion, what would a person who this happened in their family at various degrees, does a person that this happened to, do they know, like, wrong or right that has to do with other things, like being courteous to other people?
You know, every time, what's your name, by the way?
Antonio.
Antonio, every time somebody mistreats a child in any form, do they know wrong from right? And it's a real question. Because, you know, if you look at all the parents who are out there, they are so overwhelmed, so many of them. There are so many things going on where you feel just terrible about yourself as a parent. And then here comes this kid, and you say, and you somehow could let your frustrations out on this being, you know? And it's do you know it's wrong? Of course you know it's wrong. Every time you yell at a child, it's wrong. Every time you hit a child, it's wrong. Every time you expose a child to something sexual, you know it's wrong. You know it. But you're also the victim. See, you're also, as a parent, you're also powerless. Do they know it's wrong? Yes, they do. Can they not stop themselves at times? At times, it's so compulsive, they have no control. Does a compulsive behavior mean you don't lack control? Well, in a criminal sense, you know, even if you're compulsive, if you do something bad compulsively, you could be punished for it criminally.
So in my family, I grew up where my father was physically and abusive, and also physically a matter, like a batterer, and also a rageaholic, and my mother seemed to, she grew up in a family, and I guess also then being hanging around my dad like that too, she like reversed roles, and she had what I've come to realize is like an incestuous behavior, but more like emotional, more emotional incest.
And so you were the victim of this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You got
I was
beaten
the youngest sibling. I came along like 13 years after like my last, the next to last child, my brother.
Oh, so you must have gotten a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the doctors today, like even just the regular medic, says, boy, you had a lot of stuff. How do you come around and you just still smile? And I said, well,
the truth of it is
you'll go totally bonkers.
Yeah, the truth of it is you don't know what it was that graced you enough. Some kind of angel sat on your shoulder because, in all truth, you shouldn't have gotten through. And many kids don't.
Yes, yeah, it's true. That's why I consider a gift. The station's helped me a lot, too. Everybody on the station has been part of that. I'm happy that I found ways now to kind of, you know, learn about it. And that's why I'm an advocate for just telling people, look, you know, try to resolve these things. It'll make the world a better place, and start with yourself instead of trying to find the leader.
So, Antonio, what happens to you when you see somebody who's abusing a child or yelling at a child or hitting a child? What happens to you inside? What do you do?
Well, I'll give you an example. I'm very sensitive. Like, I was walking the street about 3 weeks ago, and there was a girl who was with a group of a couple other girls, and they're being, you know, kind of loud a little bit amongst themselves. And then they noticed another girl fall down about, you know, on the corner. She fell on her heels. She tripped on it, you know, and they just like immediately just burst into laughter. And that bothers me that, you know, so I try to lead life. I try to go around. If I'm going to react that way, I'm trying to be conscious. I don't want people to know that, you know, I did this human thing and, you know, I slipped and maybe I made judgment on someone. I try to go around being aware that if I'm going to say something about somebody, at least don't let them see you doing it or hear you doing it.
Yeah, I hear.
You know?
So it must be difficult for you not to step in at times if you see a child being abused.
No. That would bother me. That definitely. I would definitely do something. I don't know what I would do, depending on the situation, sure.
I wish more people would do something. Because often we see it, and, you know, one of the things we could do, of course, you know, there's one amount of it, whereas if a kid is crying from being beaten in the streets, and then you say to the parents, don't you do that to your child, the parent will later beat that child extra hard for having cried in the streets and call that attention.
Your guess said something very interesting. See, like, my father, you knew who he was. He was a rage guy, and, you know, he would right away with the hands if he wasn't feeling well in his day or whatever. But my mother's situation was a little bit different. Your guest touched on something, like she brought a little seduction into it, or sadistic, and that interested me, like to want to learn more about that. And she's a very nice lady, you know.
Your mom.
But yeah. A lot of dysfunction in the family, yeah.
I thank you for calling in, Antonio.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm glad we're here for you as well. 212-209-2900 is the number here. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. 212-209-2900. We'll take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hi, Armand. This is Ralph.
Ralph?
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
Just a question for you regarding the subject that we're talking about today. What is the justification, do you think, behind like an organization like NAMBLA? I mean, it just seems like a gigantic amount of people that all have the same idea that they're going to abuse children sexually. It just doesn't make any sense that there could be that many people and actually form a group and, you know, function in the world.
Now, tell me what you're talking about. Who is NAMBLA?
Oh, that's that National Man Boy Love Association. You've never heard of that? That's I've seen it on television. I've heard about it in a number of venues.
Well,
I mean, it's an actual thing.
Yeah, I hear it's an actual thing. And when you say it's all about abuse of children, what is it? What's the premise of NAMBLA?
Well, they advocate adult men having sex with young boys.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm surprised that you'd never heard of that.
No, it hasn't crossed my path. Something like it has crossed my path, but not that specifically. I would certainly think that it's, from the way you're describing it, it sounds pretty dysfunctional. I can't imagine that it would stay out there very long without being targeted.
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought it was a kind of a strange thing because I'd heard of it more than once in the media, and I thought I couldn't imagine that this group was allowed to
even exist. Except, you know, back in Greek-Roman times, that's the way it was done. You know, it was all that way. I mean, this is the way throughout history, the adult men with the young boys.
Right.
You know, and it was like perpetuated all the time. So I hear. And when you hear about it, you get really angry, don't you?
Well, sure. I mean, it's such an abuse, and to throw it out in a public way like that, where, you know, you've actually seen these people or heard these people trying to defend themselves. I can't imagine it. I mean, it's like advocating beating your wife, you know, and having a public forum to do it in.
Right, the National Association of Men Who Straighten Out Their Wives. Right, NISTWA, right, or something like that.
Right.
That's all you got to do is have that around for too long.
Right.
Thanks for calling us in. I will check that out, Ralph. I'll report on it. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille taking calls. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hello? Yes?
Yes.
I'd like to speak to Armand, please.
You're speaking to him now.
Oh, how are you? This is Omar calling from the West Harlem area, my
Oh,
brother.
Hello, Omar. How are you?
Okay. You know, this is some heavy stuff today, man. This is really some heavy stuff. I think that, in my humble opinion, anyone who abuses a child, I don't care if it's verbally, sexually, or physically, they should, the penalties for that should be very strong. And I say that to say that when you even verbally abuse children, it has a lasting effect on them. And if you take it further with sexual abuse, in my humble opinion, it could have a lifetime effect, and it could affect their children and generations to come. So we have to be very careful how we speak to our children, how we relate to them, especially with this new craze that they have with the computers and young kids being picked up by these degenerates or these perverts and kidnapping them and sexually abusing them. You know, here we are in the year 2005, and we realize that this is some of the most distasteful behavior that a civilized nation, and we would like to think of ourselves as being civilized, at least most of us, that it would be the most hideous thing in a civilized nation that we could allow, that even our children go to bed hungry. I believe there are millions of kids in this country with abundance of food, and here we are during the holy day season. I like to call it the holy day season. And we know this is happening, and it seems like many of us, we don't speak out. So we need more programs like what you're offering today. But brother, you are hitting home runs, or you are knocking a lot of people off their feet. And about this previous caller, Ralph, talking about this organization, I don't understand how we could allow. First of all, I've never heard of that organization, and I don't see how we could allow that. We being American citizens could allow, or citizens of the diaspora could allow organizations like that to exist today.
If you press in your computer barely legal, you'll find a whole bunch of pedophiles, sites that are dedicated to pedophiles. I mean,
my brother, I'm probably the only guy in Manhattan. I don't even have a computer. I have one. I don't even use it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really. I'm probably the only guy calling in who has a computer and who refuses to use it. This laptop my son gave me has been sitting on my desk for 2 years because I realize that a lot of the negative energy that can come in to your home and to your memory and to your existence. It's beneath me as a human being. to even stoop to those levels.
Omar, I thank you. You're a unique being, but you certainly come from your heart. Nice to talk to you again.
Salaam alaikum and happy holy days to everyone.
Right, bye-bye. 212-209-2900. Nice to be able to hear from you people. It's been... Hi, you're on the air.
I'm on the air.
Yes.
Can't believe it. Let me turn off my radio. Wow. You know, there's so few female callers. I just need to comment on that. But this subject has really got me freaked out. I was sexually abused by my stepfather and neglected by my mother. And I went on to have all kinds of horrible experiences. And I have to say that I've been violently raped by strangers. And that didn't even compare, even minutely, to the much more, I don't know what you call it, like gentle or benign or whatever kind of abuse you want to call it that I received from my stepfather because I trusted him. And it was so hard to be angry with him, and I didn't feel like I had a right to say no. But with strangers who you don't know, and you don't feel like you owe them anything, and you don't love them, and you don't trust them, and they haven't done anything for you, you can get angry, and you can fight back. And so therefore, that hasn't even touched me. It didn't touch the core of me. But what my stepfather did was so small in comparison in terms of physical violence or physical damage. But it was like a mind game thing that harmed me so badly.
Sure.
And I think this really needs to be talked about.
Took away your trust. It robbed you of your trust.
Forever. And I now have a 15-year-old daughter, and I'm really losing it. And, you know, I mean, when she was 3, I taught her how to make a proper fist. You know, I've had her in martial arts classes. When she was a baby, I found this wonderful book called It's My Body. And I don't even know if it's easy to find now. I don't even know where I got it, but it's called My Body, and it's a book written for children. And it's very simple, but it talks about all kinds of inappropriate touching. And there's a role play at the back of the book where you role play with your kid, and you say, "It's my body. I don't like the way you're touching me. Stop right now." And I will tell. And I don't know if I tortured the poor kid, but I would read this book, and then I would say, we'd do the role play, and she'd say, "It's my body. Stop touching me." I'd say, "No, say it meaner. Say it louder." But I think I've been almost like over to an extreme in terms of feeling protective. And I've been in near fist fights in the streets because now she's 15 and she's voluptuous and men look at her. And I know she deals with this all the time when I'm not there present. And she pretty much knows how to handle herself really well, I think. But when I'm present and men look at her or make rude comments, I have been close to, like, blows. And I just think that women need to be much more proactive, even if it means being violent, to protect themselves and their kids.
Well, I agree with you on that. What's your name, by the way?
Oh, my name is Gabriella.
Gabriella, I agree with you. And the one thing that seems to be evident, and I found that in this book that was written about it that from a guest we spoke to earlier, is that if you've gone through this kind of thing, of course, the danger is you wind up reacting to it in such a way that you form your child into being, a terrified of men. And, of course, you don't want to do that, and I could tell right. You haven't done that. But, you know, that's why I think individual counseling
which I've been in for years and years.
And how helpful was it to you?
You know, I have to tell you this. I don't feel like it's been helpful much at all.
Good. Tell me what they missed. Tell me why it wasn't helpful, because you may be right.
Okay, it's kept me clean and sober for 16 years.
Well, that's a big deal, huh?
That's a big help. And it keeps me from, blabbing my problems to, anybody who will listen. And that's helped. But, I don't know, around the age 35, I made up my mind that the second half of my life was going to be better than the first half. And I think I set myself up for the depression I have now because I made the decision that I was going to go to therapy 2-3 times a week, read every self-help book, you know, do anything in my power to be healed by the time I was 40, so that the second half of my life would be, like, not tainted with everything that happened in the first half. And I turned 40, and now I'm about to turn 42, and I feel like I'm worse today than I was ever before. And it's so depressing. Mm. It's so depressing to feel like I'm no better than I was when I, you know, when I was 14. And I just don't know what to think about that.
I understand what you're saying, you know, Gabrielle. I've certainly, from your perspective, the way you feel now, you've taken away a lot of your defenses. You've taken away a lot of the things that would keep you from facing yourself. The kind of depression you have now is what they call a narcissistic realization. You're looking at yourself and saying, who am I?
Yes.
You know, I am nobody.
Yes.
Well, that's the beginning, Gabriella. The I am nobody is the beginning of finding out that you're a somebody, because what most people do is they make believe they're somebody all their lives. You've challenged it, and there is going to be a transitory phase, a transition, that's going to be just like this. It's going to be painful. And when you get through this pain, you'll be clearer. And if you need help, call me, and I'll find you the help you need to go through the next step.
I appreciate you giving me that information, because just surviving from one day to another is so difficult, and the only reason I bother is because I have to raise my daughter, and I have to raise her to be strong.
I hear that. I hear that. But there's another piece to it, Gabriella. You know, don't let them rob you. Those first 42 years, they weren't for nothing. This is just the time that you're going to go through. When you come out of this one, you're going to get your reward.
Oh, God, I hope so.
Yeah.
And I just want to say one further thing. When I confronted my stepfather when I was about 32, he killed himself. He didn't apologize. He didn't say anything. He just killed himself.
I wish
he had killed himself 20 years earlier. And let me tell you this. If I felt a compulsion to hurt children, especially in a sexual way, if I had to kill myself or lock myself in a closet in order to stop myself, that's what I would do. And I think that anyone who has a compulsion has an obligation to do whatever it takes to stop themselves. And I don't believe that people can't control themselves. If it means taking your own life in order to not abuse a child, then I think that's the right thing to do, and that's what I would do. And I wish more people would do something like that.
Gabriella, thank you for calling in. Thank you.
I'm really glad I got a chance to say that, and I thank you for hearing me.
Sure. Thank you.
This
is Armand DeMille with our wonderful guests. We're going to be we're going to have to be leaving right now. We'll be back with you on Wednesday of next week. If you want a copy of today's program, you'd call 212-757-4488, or you'd look on the website, thepositivemind.com, where you'll be able to find today's program streamed. My heart goes out to all of you. Be back with you on Wednesday at 1 p.m.
This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The previous program, The Positive Mind, with Armand DeMille, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. And as Armand said, he won't be on next Tuesday, but he'll be on Wednesday at 1 p.m. If the previous program was of importance to you, please consider supporting this radio station with a financial contribution by logging on to our website, WBAI.org, and make that financial contribution to keep programs like The Positive Mind and all the programs that you hear on WBAI, listener-sponsored and commercial-free. Coming up next at 2 p.m. will be Perspective with Luis Reyes Rivera. Talk back with Hugh Hamilton at 3, the Community Bulletin Board at 4:55, and at 5 p.m., Behind the News with Doug Henwell. Please stay tuned.
Thursday, 7 p.m. on December 1st at CUNY Graduate Center. This country's hottest young changemakers will be reading from the newly released collection, Letters from Young Activists, Today's Rebels Speak Out. Where are we headed next? Find out on December 1st at 34th and 5th Avenue at 7 p.m. Hear today's freshest political voices, angry, innovative, and wise. For more information about this event, go to lettersfromyoungactivists.org. That's lettersfromyoungactivists.org.
For these times, I especially send these rhymes. I want to seize mine, so please be kind to rewind each line. Till you read to teach you to find a way out of these binds.
December 1st, 1955.
December 1st marks the 50th anniversary when Rosa Parks, the entire black community of Montgomery, Alabama, and a little-known preacher named King determined that they were not going to stand for Jim Crow and racial segregation anymore. And so on Thursday, December 1st, 2005, the Essex County LOC of the Millions More Movement calls on Christians, Muslims, and people of all faith to arise and stand to meet the challenges of our time. The unity meeting begins at 6:30 p.m. at Muhammad's Mosque, number 25, 312 Washington Street, Newark, New Jersey. Guest speakers include Reverend Ron Christian of the Christian Love Baptist Church and Minister Akbar Muhammad of the Nation of Islam. For more information, please call 973-624-5532. That's 973-624-5532. Thank you, Mr.